Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First up today, a little bit of stock market truth-telling. Then a fond or not-so-fond, perhaps, farewell to the office cubicle. And finally, a little guitar music to go out on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the first day of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And we will begin the top of the news today with the place that we end the newscast every day, Wall Street and its doings. One of the biggest movers on this Wednesday was GoDaddy. The website domain registry went public this morning. Spokesperson and race car driver Danica Patrick in attendance and everything did pretty well, too. Trading under the ticker symbol GDDY, shares up $6 or so, about 30%. Of course, not everybody was able to get the checkered flag. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tallies up who wins when an IPO surges.
When a company goes public, it starts with a price that it thinks is fair. When that price then shoots up on the first day of trading, it is called
the pop.
Jay Ritter is professor of finance at the University of Florida. The average pop is about 18%. It is true that if there's a giant pop, a company might have a facepalm moment and say, ugh, we should have priced higher.
They're not getting as much in proceeds as they could have.
But think about the opposite of a pop. Think about a fizzle. Let's say you had a greedy little piggy of a company that priced high to squeeze out every last drop of profit it could.
That basically shuts down the pipeline of other people who might want to buy the stock.
David Menlow is president of IPO Financial. They predict and research IPO prices.
Investors still need to believe that there is room for more demand on the upside.
Bill Blay is executive vice president of Loyal 3, a registered broker-dealer. He says you need to start with the old razzle-dazzle.
Stocks that don't pop, that go in the opposite direction, generally have a hard time regaining the momentum in the stock.
And don't forget about the banks. The banks are the ones putting on the whole IPO dog and pony show to begin with. They want stocks to jump because that's how they reward their biggest clients, letting them buy undervalued shares before public trading starts, before the... In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, has clearly learned a thing or two this week from Governor Mike Pence over in Indiana. This morning, Hutchinson said he is not going to sign his state's version of a Religious Freedom Act, the one that has gotten Pence in so much hot water the past couple of days. Those signs on business windows that say, we reserve the right to refuse service to anybody, they are legal if somebody is being really, really troublesome. You can throw them out. But refusing service to a category of people is discrimination, as well as not being exactly in the interests of most businesses, which tend to want as many customers as possible. Marketplace's Gigi Duban takes it from there.
The reality is this. Businesses discriminate against people all the time. Think of someone getting rowdy at a bar who gets booted out. And a business owner can do that. Kirk Hansen is executive director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University.
They can take somebody who comes in smelling and someone who's going to cause difficulty because of some characteristic.
That characteristic can't be someone's race. Federal law prohibits that kind of discrimination at public accommodation places like grocery and hardware stores. As a class, minorities are protected. And Hansen says what's been happening in Indiana might lead to gays and lesbians being covered as a protected class.
This fight may well be the rising crescendo to getting sexual orientation covered in the federal law.
For now, even under Indiana's extremely controversial law, a business refusing to serve gays and lesbians might not be able to justify its actions. Ramesh Panuru is a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute.
You know, it's going to be a lot easier, I think, to make the case under religious freedom law that your faith does not permit you to participate in a same-sex wedding than it does to make the case your faith doesn't permit you to serve gay customers at all.
Legally, he says, those are very different situations. What's baffling to Elliot Richardson, CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council in Chicago, is that businesses generally try to reach customers.
So as a business owner, excluding customers seems counterintuitive. Most of the time, you're going to sell to everybody as long as they can pay for it.
As some Indiana businesses have already learned, customers make choices as to where they do business, too. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Ending the newscast as promised with Wall Street gets us nowhere good. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big trend in office design for a good while now has been open floor plans. All the cool companies are doing it. But when you get right down to, you know, actually working, are open plan offices really all that? Marketplace's Sally Herships looked into it.
Marketplace's New York Bureau is partially open plan, but most of it is rooms with doors that close. Some are beautiful and light-filled. Then there is the office of Tobin Lowe, digital production assistant.
Meg pointed out to me once that I could actually get scurvy if I, because I have a terrible diet and there's no windows in this room.
Meg Kramer, assistant producer, sits near a window, which is sort of open plan. Her desk is in the hallway. What Marketplace's New York Bureau doesn't have a lot of is common space, which is the hot trend right now in office design. GlaxoSmithKline just paid, it won't say how much, to design a new 200,000-square-foot glass building in Philadelphia, which is entirely open plan. The company is pretty excited. It even made a YouTube video about the space.
It's a whole new way of working.
I'll admit it. At first, I was nervous about leaving my old office and cubicle setup. But I love working in the open environment.
How could I not visit this place? What is that woman sitting in over there?
Oh, those are very cool chairs. You want to see those? We can go see that.
Ray Malora is head of design and change management at GSK. He says the company strategically placed special chairs throughout the building for workers who need a quiet place to sit. It looks like a chair that wants to give me a hug, and it's purple. The new building feels a little like a hotel. There's a coffee shop and a spiral staircase in the atrium, which is huge and has lots of windows and light. But there are no offices and no assigned seats. Instead, groups get put in neighborhoods. Every morning, you get your stuff, post-it notes and stapler out of a locker, and decide which desk you want.
Why not just let people have their own desks and then also give them the choice of switching spaces?
Because we're trying to keep movement in the environment. We're trying to keep people moving around.
Malora says the idea is to encourage workers to talk to colleagues they might otherwise never interact with. Interaction is the big trend right now in the world of offices, but it can also be hard to get right.
The amount you talk to other people is never predictive of how productive or happy you are.
Ben Weber is president and CEO of Sociometric Solutions. The company uses Bluetooth to track workers, where they tend to go in the office and who they typically interact with. It compares those behaviors with how happy and productive they are. Turns out it's not how much you talk to your coworkers.
It's the pattern of communication. Do I talk to a lot of people that know each other? Do I talk to lots of people in different groups?
Weber tells a story about a large manufacturing company whose salespeople sat in cubicles.
The company said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to spend millions of dollars. We're going to build out a beautiful new open plan office setting. It's going to be great. Lots of daylight. Fantastic. And they did that.
But it didn't work. Sorry, cube haters. The cubicles were actually better. Weber says in the old setup, the sales team talked to each other about how to sell more. When the office went open plan, they talked more, but to other coworkers instead. He says the problem today is instead of thinking about what specific employee needs are, some companies are too focused on trying to be trendy.
Isn't it ironic? You know, I started researching this in 1976.
Alan Hedge teaches ergonomics at Cornell.
And here we are nearly 40 years later, and it's come back into fashion.
He says the open plan office is a German idea from the middle of the last century.
Bürolandschaft. Büro, which is the German for office, and then Landschaft, which was landscape.
Hedge says the original open plan offices failed. Workers were unhappy with noise and lack of privacy. He says the same concerns exist today. That's why in open plan offices, headphones have become the new office door. Bottom line, Hedge says office design is like fashion.
The latest trend is to say, let's get rid of cubicles, let's get rid of private offices, let's create these vast open spaces and life will be wonderful. Well, it won't.
And another trend that won't make office life wonderful, standing desks. Hedge says if we stand for more than about 6 to 8 minutes, we are going to get tired. Instead, he says he has a magic formula. Sit for 20, stand for 8, and move for 2, which will make you healthier and more productive. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The list of companies that have raised their minimum wage lately, companies like Walmart and Target and TJ Maxx, got one company longer today. McDonald's said it is going to raise pay 10% or a dollar more than the local minimum wage at the 1,500-ish restaurants that the company operates directly. Works out to about 90,000 people getting a bump, which the company's new CEO said will bring pay up to just shy of $10 an hour come July. McDonald's did say it hopes its franchisees would follow suit. That would cover about 90% of McDonald's employees. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark from the Wealth and Poverty Desk is following the story for us. Hey, Chrissy.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So give me some, all these stories need context and perspective, which is why you're here. Give me some of that.
Okay. So a few things to put in perspective. These increases do come after several years of wages barely keeping up with inflation across the board. So in some ways, this is a bit of a game of catch up. But it could be a hopeful sign that as the economy is beginning to pick up some speed, there's pressure in the American labor market to raise wages. For example, as maybe more skilled workers who got that job at a fast food restaurant because that's the only job they could find, now jobs that they're more qualified for, that are better paying, are starting to open up. So they're leaving, which means that then there's more competition, and it inspires McDonald's to say, well, we've got to pay a little bit higher to attract people.
The fast food workers have been walking out on day strikes, on longer actions for a good long while now, a couple of years. Have we heard from them on this yet?
There have been some McDonald's workers who've started to say things. Of course, they want to claim some of the credit.
Yeah.
One McDonald's worker who is paid about $7.25 an hour right now said, because we joined together and stood up, McDonald's was forced to raise pay. But of course, they also make the caveat that a dollar extra in their wages when they're starting from so little is still not going to make a huge difference in their lives.
10% on a small amount is still a small amount. Connect the economic dots for me. Once these people and others throughout the economy who are getting raises, once that happens, then what happens?
Right. Well, more money in workers' pockets, of course, means they have more money to spend. And that can be a boost for our economy more generally, which relies very heavily on consumer spending. But second, sort of to the McDonald's workers' point, the pay increases that we're talking about here at McDonald's, at Walmart, also at, you know, at a lot of the companies that have announced pay raises in the last couple of months, for someone on a budget, yes, every penny helps, but it's not going to transform people's lives. In fact, a wage of $10 an hour is still going to mean for many of those families that they still qualify for public assistance. In fact, IKEA, which announced their wage raise last summer, they're the only company so far that has tied their wage raises to a living wage calculator, where they're actually trying to say, we want to make sure that you don't have to rely on public assistance in order to, if you're working for us.
Right.
That's different than some of these other wage increases that we've been hearing about.
McDonald's raising its pay, and it comes on a week where we're going to get the jobs numbers on Friday, which will include some of that wage pressure information that Chrissy started with. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Chrissy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Coming up.
With a wad of dollar bills in my pocket, I hopped on the downtown bus and was standing in front of Maze Music when they opened the doors at 10.
The story is what he traded those dollar bills for. Our series, The Transaction, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Welcome to the first day of the rest of the second quarter, everybody. The Dow Industrial's off 0.4% today, 77 points, 17,698 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 0.4%, 20 points, finished at 4880. And not to be left out, the S&P 500 also gave back 0.4%. That is 8 points, closed at 2,059. Weak economic data on manufacturing and private sector employment were part of the problem today. Financial firms mixed. You might say J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew 0.3%, but Morgan Stanley bumped up 0.7%. We told you about McDonald's. Yeah, Mickey D's share price dropped 1.2%. Today, Sotheby's held its first live auction with the online auction house eBay. And by the end of the trading day, 0.7% of Sotheby's market cap was going once, going twice. Yes, sold off. Sold off. Get it? Automakers hit reverse after reporting disappointing March sales. GM down 2% on the news. Ford forfeited 1.4%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for February. The Senate Small Business and Entrepreneurship Committee is in Louisiana for a hearing on reducing the federal tax burden for America's small businesses. And April is Stress Awareness Month. Are you aware of your stress? Let's count to 10. Pay attention, people! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did a story yesterday about free college education. No scholarships involved, though. No free academic or athletic rides involved. Air travel, however, will be necessary. Germany is one of a number of countries, many of them in Europe, in which higher education comes taxpayer-paid. Surprising absolutely nobody, a growing number of foreign students are Germany-bound, letting taxpayers there pick up the tab for their college educations. But there are some trade-offs. In the second of two reports, WGBH's Kirk Carapezza checks in with American students studying abroad.
At a cafe just around the corner from the University of Cologne, students sink into big armchairs and sip lattes. This is Rachel Smith's favorite place to spend downtime between classes.
I love it. I love it here. I really like the city. I love the culture.
The 26-year-old from Syracuse, New York, is working on her master's degree in environmental science and has been living in Germany for 2 years. She's one of almost 100 American students studying at the University of Cologne. And like all of them, she's doing it for free.
I feel like, how did I get away with this? Like, how did I manage to make this happen?
Today, more than 150,000 international students are getting degrees here, including more than 4,000 Americans. That's double what it was just 5 years ago.
When an American student reaches out to me and says that they're interested, I talk to them and find out as much as I can.
That's Jay Malone. Jay's from Ohio, got his master's degree in political science in Germany, and stuck around to start a college consulting firm focused on bringing Americans here. I hopped in the car with Jay on a scouting mission to the University of Siegen. It's one of the places he'll take a group of American high schoolers visiting in June.
What kind of student would want to study at this university?
I think it would be a student who kind of wants to get out of the city. Siegen is a smaller regional capital.
Smaller and beautiful. Siegen is nestled among the hills east of the Rhineland. On this afternoon, a light dusting of snow covers the pointed roofs and slate-tiled cottages of the city's old town.
You see that, the slate siding? That's, like, typical Siegerland.
In Siegen, we met Delisha Doran, an American studying German, who says while she's enjoyed the international experience, there are downsides.
You're gonna cry a lot. Like, you're gonna miss home a ton.
Doran also misses the luxuries available at many American schools.
I miss having a gym 5 minutes away. I miss having a cafeteria that will give me endless food for the whole day.
And of course, there's the language barrier. Germany is offering more programs in English. The government will even pay for language classes. It wants these students here, even though German taxpayers foot the bill.
If you look at Germany, the only resource we do have are human resources, actually.
Dorothea Ruland is Secretary General of the German Academic Exchange Service, or DAAD, which is in charge of Germany's international push.
We depend on innovation, on inventions, of course, and where do they come from? From institutions of higher education or from research institutions. So you have to have big international networks.
Half of foreign students getting a degree here will stay. And not just for the short term, 40% plan on being here for at least 10 years. In the U.S., only 12% of international students opt to stay for even 1 year. Back in Cologne, we met up with a group of Americans who are now part of that international network Roland talked about.
And your dream would be to stay here?
That's my plan at the moment, yeah. I want to see what the workforce is like here, like a full-time job, and see if I enjoy it.
That was Andrew Kinder, who's studying business. His classmate, Natasha Turner, wasn't so sure.
I don't know. No, I don't. But I don't have to, you know? And so I know employers on both sides of the ocean will look at my CV and be like, oh, that looks good. So I'm employable anywhere.
Employers agree. So if Natasha doesn't want to come back to the States, she doesn't really have to. America still has enough talent and enough students for now. In Cologne, Germany, I'm Kurt Carapeza for Marketplace.
All right, it's your turn. Would you pay higher taxes to make higher education free? Weigh in and take our poll at marketplace.org. The stuff that we buy, the big stuff and sometimes the small stuff too, often becomes, in one way or another, a part of our lives and sometimes even changes our lives. We've got a series we do every now and then. It's called The Transaction, about how the seemingly simple exchange of goods or services can matter. Today's story from listener Jose Antonio Ponce starts in Albuquerque, New Mexico, back in 1970.
When I was 13, my brother Patrick decided to teach me a few chords on the guitar. I learned A, D, E. Soon after those first lessons, he left Albuquerque for a job in southern New Mexico, and he took his guitars with him. But by that time, I had become enthralled. The first chance I got, I took a bus from the North Valley to downtown Albuquerque and walked into Maze Music on Central Avenue. I strolled up and down the aisles admiring the guitars, some as expensive as $200. The only guitar that was remotely within my reach was hanging on the wall behind the counter. It was a used Yamaha nylon string classical guitar with a black and white sign that proclaimed, "On sale, $25. That I could do. I got back on the bus, went home, went to my dad to ask for the money. "Okay," he said, "but you'll have to earn the money yourself." Fortunately, it was summer, and so between picking watermelons for the little Japanese man who ran the farm at the end of the Tucker Road and loading alfalfa bales onto a flatbed for Mr. Gutierrez, after a month of sporadic work, I had almost enough for that guitar, and my dad chipped in the rest. With a wad of dollar bills in my pocket, I hopped on the downtown bus and was standing in front of Maze Music when they opened the doors at 10. I couldn't wait to get inside, walked immediately to the counter, pointed at the used Yamaha on the wall and said, "I want to buy that guitar." The clerk took the guitar off the wall, removed the tag, and totaled up the price on the adding machine. "With tax, that'll be $41.95. I was stunned. I stood there not knowing what to say, holding my fist full of $1 bills. It had a sign on it saying it was $25 the last time I was here. "Oh, that was last month during our anniversary sale," he said. I didn't know what to do. I felt sick to my stomach. I stood there for a minute. I turned and headed out the door, trying my best not to cry from embarrassment. I was halfway down the block when I heard someone yelling at me. "Hey, kid, wait up." It was the store clerk. "How much money have you got?" I knew I had $25 in my hand. I reached into my pocket for the remaining change and counted it. $26.40, I said. "Sold." We walked back to the store, and he pulled the guitar off the wall, wiped it down with a rag, and handed it to me with a smile. I thanked him and thanked him and thanked him again. I had spent every penny I had, including my bus fare, and I remember nearly skipping the 8 miles home. That one transaction, that one act of kindness by a sales clerk toward a kid devastated by his own poverty, completely changed my life. It led me into a career as a songwriter, musician, and writer. And I was a loyal customer of Maze Music until they closed years later.
This last song here is Bob Dylan. All the rest of them were Jose playing. This is one of those series we do that just doesn't work without you helping us out. So take a second, go to marketplace.org and tell us the story of your transaction. This final note on the way out today, in which we find out officially how serious the drought out here in California really is. Today, Governor Jerry Brown ordered a mandatory 25% reduction in water use statewide, first time that has ever happened. Brown made the announcement standing at a ski resort up in the Sierra Nevada, where there was nary a flake of snow to be seen, a spot at which the governor said there should be 5 feet of snow this time of year. Think agriculture and all the produce that the Central Valley grows if you're looking for the marketplace angle on this one. We, by the way, have done a whole bunch of water coverage lately. A lot of it on our homepage, marketplace.org. Check it out. It's some good stuff.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All right, we got to go. The Dow off 0.4% today, 77 points. The NASDAQ down 0.4%, 20 points. The S&P 500 also gave back, yes, indeedy, 0.4%, 8 points. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Cologne, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.